Good morning, and may it please the court. Lisa Schertler, representing the appellant Tijani Sani. Mr. Sani's sentencing was infected by legal errors that should be corrected at a new sentencing proceeding conducted before a different judge. I'd like to begin with the guidelines errors that we contend occurred, and precisely beginning with acceptance of responsibility. Three separate legal errors occurred in the course of the district court's ruling denying Mr. Sani credit for acceptance of responsibility. The first of those legal errors is that in violation of Hicks and 3E1.1, the court considered Mr. Sani's failure to cooperate with an ongoing investigation on which he maintained a Fifth Amendment privilege when it denied Mr. Sani credit.
Why isn't the more germane case In Re Sealed Case, where and we should consider Mr. Sani's undisclosed income as part of the crime itself?
Judge Griffith, I think that what 3E1.1 states is that a defendant is not required to affirmatively admit.
You want to put this under the relevant conduct prong. I'm saying, why doesn't it fit better under the other prong? In a sealed case, we said a defendant who failed to disclose the source of his drug supply didn't get the benefit of what you're asking for. And why isn't that this case? He didn't disclose the source of the income.
Because the offensive conviction was not related to the source of the income. The offensive conviction was failing to disclose these foreign bank accounts and the money in them. The question about the source of the income and whether that was illegal was a matter on which Mr. Sani clearly retained a Fifth Amendment privilege. And what this court said in Hicks was that that constitutional problem is now avoided by 3E1.1 as it is written, which says that where a Fifth Amendment privilege relates to an offense that is not the offense of conviction, it is not a proper consideration under 3E1.1. We would say that in this case, the source of the funds was much more separate than was the source of the drugs in In Re Sealed Case. Mm-hmm. That was not asking that defendant to disclose a separate crime. That was asking the defendant to disclose the circumstances of the crime of conviction.
So in In Re Sealed Case, he would have been no more jeopardy by telling that Lefty was the source of the drugs?
That's our position. And here you do have explicit continuing jeopardy in the form of the government's continuing investigation into possible bribery. The government, and I would just add,
The sentencing report and the judge's statements on the bench suggest that the defendant was unforthcoming not only with regard to the source of the funds, but with regard to where the bank accounts were, with regard to balances, transactions. Basically told them to go fetch, and they had to find what they could in the course of investigation, which took place over time because things were not turned up right away. He could have saved them all that effort, but chose not to, without disclosing anything about the source of the funds. So why isn't that a valid ground for denying acceptance?
Well, Judge Ginsburg, you would be referring to the investigation that the government undertook to reveal the crime that he did admit to. To committing.
Also an ongoing investigation, but into the crime of conviction.
Well, Your Honor,
relevant to the, for instance, the fine to be levied.
That goes to the district court's point of reliance on Mr. Sani's, what it called his failure to be forthcoming with probation. Now, we would submit, Your Honor, that the very same Fifth Amendment concerns were present with respect to those disclosures to probation that were requested. The whole government investigation was into Mr. Sani's finances and obviously where the money came from. Mr. Sani retained...
Where the money came from is potentially incriminating. Where the money is does not seem to be potentially incriminating.
Well, if there is... further money I don't know, if there's further, any disclosure by Mr. Sahni of attempting to lay bare his financial situation would have been feeding right into the investigation that the government was continuing to conduct, whether it led to future, additional tax violations, or it led to some sort of additional finding with respect to bribery. And Your Honor, we would just point out that the government itself affirmatively pressed this theory of 3E1.1 in its sentencing memo, and the district court embraced it and never acknowledged that 3E1.1 has its limitations that preclude these considerations.
He was advised by counsel, is that correct, not to cooperate?
The government was asked by the district court judge the circumstances under which Mr. Sahni had declined to cooperate with the ongoing investigation. And my recollection was that the prosecutor indicated that through counsel he had declined. Yes, sir. But there's a second error that occurred in the...
When that happens, how does this work? And say... Is counsel present with the probation officer interview?
I believe that counsel was present. I believe that is in the pre-sentence report, yes, sir.
And does counsel then make a Fifth Amendment or prompt this client to make a Fifth Amendment assertion?
I don't know precisely what happened in this case because there is not a record of that, but that would be my expectation. That would be what I would assume. That's what I would infer based on the probation officer's report that through counsel, Mr. Sahni had indicated that the probation officer should rely on the extensive financial information that the government had already provided and could provide to it, and then it did so. And on the point of the fine, Your Honor, we also would emphasize here that Mr. Sahni agreed to the maximum permissible fine, which was twice the tax loss underlying his offenses of conviction.
I think you just said the tax loss was an uncertain amount until because he wasn't forthcoming on the balance.
Well, based on the offenses with which he was charged and he pled guilty across the board, the tax loss was calculated. Now, whether some additional crimes could have been disclosed if he were to, as I say, lay bare to a government officer, the probation office, his full finances, I don't know. But on this record, he agreed to the maximum possible fine. The idea, the district court's notion that it was handicapped in calculating that fine, we would submit does not stand up.
The PSR, which is not in the appendix, does indicate at page 15, paragraph 67, at the initial interview on the advice of counsel, the defendant refused to respond to any questions asked by this officer as contained on the net worth statement and monthly cash flow statement. According to counsel, the government conducted an extensive investigation and analysis of the defendant's assets and liabilities. It was then suggested that this officer obtain the information directly from the government. Furthermore, the defendant did not provide documentation of his finances. Now, I'm not sure what the significance of that initial interview provision is. It may mean that from the outset and thereafter, forever, and it may mean just in the initial interview. Do you know the answer to that?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I have no knowledge of a subsequent interview that was done for him that the record would show.
Okay. Thank you.
If I could move on to the... We have a second legal error associated with the acceptance of responsibility ruling, and that is that the district court on the record informed Mr. Sahni that if he entered a guilty plea by the date of the pretrial conference, acceptance of responsibility credit would be no problem. That was an assurance, an explicit assurance made by the district court. And as the Supreme Court recognized in Saldana, there is a baseline level of fairness that is required to be demonstrated in federal sentencing proceedings. And as they there held, when a district court indicates clearly that it's going to act one way at sentencing and then acts a different way, those principles are violated. That also is a separate legal error that requires remand on the acceptance of responsibility finding. And third, we have a third legal error. Now, in the district court's ruling on acceptance of responsibility, it explicitly referred to the fact that Mr. Sani oversaw $750 million in procurement actions, thousands of contracts. The defense had explicitly challenged the government's assertion regarding Mr. Sani's level of responsibility in its sentencing memo. And it called into question the reliability of the electronic mail in which the government relied to support its assertion. That was a contested issue of fact. The district court did not demand that the government provide further corroboration or support for its assertion, and it did not make a finding on it, and yet here it is, an explicit part of the ruling on acceptance of responsibility. Based on all three of those legal errors, Your Honors, we would submit that a reversal and remand is required. I'd like now to turn to the separate guideline departure that the court imposed under 5K2.7.
I would ask you, why wasn't it enough for the district court to say, this is a very unusual case, the guidelines just aren't that helpful to me here? Okay. What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that is that Gall precludes it.
How so?
Gall sets out a procedure, and I think this is a very important theme in this case. Gall makes clear that although district courts retain a great deal of discretion in ultimately setting a sentence in a case, they earn this court's deference by following procedures that give the sentencing process an integrity. And those procedures are, you first arrive at a correct guidelines range. Second, you consider that guidelines range when you decide what sentence to impose under 3553. Third, if you elect to impose a sentence outside of the guideline range, you give serious consideration to the extent of the variance that you're going to grant, and you justify it.
And why do you think that wasn't done in this case? Certainly it wasn't done as elegantly as saying check, check, check. But each of those elements were part of the district court's determination.
Well,
started with the guideline range, said it didn't apply in this case, and then cited reasons why there ought to be a departure from it, given these other factors.
Judge Griffith, the first step is a correct guidelines range, and our position is that this district court did not ever arrive at a correct guidelines range because it made errors on the acceptance of responsibility legal errors that we've already discussed, and also a legal error in imposing this four-level departure under 5K2.7. Those guidelines errors require reversal and remand. You don't, and
what's the 5K2.7 error?
Your Honor, 5K2.7.
I know what it is, but I mean, I don't understand why it's clear error, which I think it has to be, or an abuse of discretion in what the district court calculated in our 5K2.7 here. Disrupting governmental functions, that seems pretty obvious.
Well, the offense of conviction must result in a disruption of governmental disruption of governmental function. Our position is that in all the cases that we have found in that guideline, every single one, that requires a cause and effect between the offenses of conviction here, the conduct, failing to file complete tax returns, and the disruption of governmental function. This is not a case where you had that cause and effect.
All you're saying is that all the cases you found, there's a direct result. Is there anything in the language of the guidelines that prevents us from finding an indirect result?
That very phrase, the offense and the language of the guideline, is that the defendant's conduct must result in a significant disruption of a governmental function. That we would submit suggested.
Go ahead.
That we would submit means that there is a direct cause and effect. In this case, the theory on which the district.
Why did the government undertake massive investigations into all of the contracts that had anything to do with Mr. Sani? Why?
Not because he had committed his offenses of conviction, and we know that because their investigation began well before they ever knew about that. And so even on that government's theory that you have met the result in requirement here.
Whether they knew about it is different than whether the conduct caused it, right?
Well, the conduct could not have caused the government to undertake that investigation because the government had utterly no knowledge of the conduct when it undertook the investigation. I mean, there's a chronology problem with the government's claim that they have actually met the result in requirement by the facts here. This investigation began at point A. At point B, the defendant's tax problems are discovered. And then the investigation continues to point C. Even on the government's theory, you do not have a resulting investigation based on the defendant's offenses of conviction. But we would also submit that entire theory is not what this guideline was aimed at. It would be very easy to draft a guideline.
The investigation that began before focusing on Sonny had to do with corruption in this office.
That's my understanding, yes, sir.
Yeah. The investigation triggered around Sonny had to do with all of the contracts in which he had played a part.
I'm sorry, say that once more time.
The investigation leading to the conviction had to do with all of the contracts in which he had played a part, right? Where he had become the focus at that point of the subject of the investigation.
Actually, I don't know that the record shows that, Your Honor. I think that there was a broad investigation of the office of which he was a part. And during the course of that investigation, his particular tax offenses were discovered.
And then began another disruption, which is that they had to look into every contract that he had fingerprints on.
But they were conducting this broad investigation of that entire office already. And so the fact that they continued the very same investigation they had begun, we would say, disproves that causal link that's required under the guideline. And it would be very easy to draft a guideline that compensates for use of investigative resources to prosecute the crime. This is not drafted that way, and it has never been interpreted that way in
what
any
about
other
when
case.
It's a government official who's engaged in serious tax offenses, and the person has a position of great responsibility, important position. Isn't that in itself a long way to showing significant disruption of a governmental function?
Well, Your Honor, not a significant disruption of a governmental function that has resulted from the offense of conviction. That is where we do not think that the link is there. We agree with you, Judge Kavanaugh, that what the government's interpretation of this guideline does is it makes it focus on really the identity of the defendant as a government employee.
I think that's right.
And
what's wrong with that?
Well, what is wrong with that is that's not what the guideline says. And there are and we know that the drafters of the guidelines know how to focus on that particular offender characteristic when they choose to, because they've done it in a number of other substantive guidelines. And the problem with basically imputing that consideration into this guideline, one of the problems, is that it really puts it in the power of the prosecuting authorities to decide to, you know, investigate a government employee to their heart's content, whether it's necessary or not, because it gives them the power to then demand a departure of any duration. There's no set departure range here, and this is one of the problems, is that the district court didn't justify its departure. But it leads to a system that was not intended by this guideline.
Ms. Shirley, you've used your time for
thank
questions.
You.
We'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. May it please the court. Kevin Gingras on behalf of the United States. The district court did not procedurally err in calculating the guidelines in this case. The district court took a careful and cautious approach, as evidenced by its decision to bifurcate the sentencing proceedings, dedicating the first hearing solely to the question of getting the guidelines calculation correct. The district court explained in its prefatory comments that can be found in the joint appendix at 194 that this case was, quote, too important to just sort of whip it off, so to speak, that the calculations had to be, quote, reflected on, and that the case deserves, quote, careful reflection. And the district court also mentioned that it was going to take a significant amount of time, what ended up being several weeks, so that it'd have a chance to, quote, figure out what's the right answer to these questions. This is not a district court that just rode roughshod over the defendant or was just going through the motions in the guidelines calculations. It gave the process, as my friend has said, integrity.
How do you respond to counsel's argument that, the district court didn't follow the Gall prescription here, that there's a way to go about doing this, and he just wasn't careful enough in following Gall? Didn't start with a correct guidelines calculation, didn't give an adequate explanation based on statutory factors for why there should be a departure from that?
I think we would disagree that the record reflects that. The district court started by correctly calculating the guidelines, and I'll go through the points that my friend has made with regard to acceptance and the governmental disruption. But we think the government did correctly calculate the guidelines and did so carefully and cautiously. I can start with...
You said the government did?
I apologize, the court. Clearly the government didn't, because the government had suggested some other adjustments higher that the district court did not agree with, and that the district court found that the government didn't meet its burden of proof. So if I could just start with the Fifth Amendment claim with regard to acceptance of responsibility. The defendant is attempting to raise a Fifth Amendment claim by alleging that the district court denied the acceptance of responsibility adjustment on the basis of his unwillingness to cooperate in these other investigations, and that he wouldn't talk about the source of the income or the source of the funds that he had in these foreign accounts. What the district court did was it actually and appropriately considered whether the defendant had admitted the conduct comprising the offense of conviction. For conviction under 7206, the tax, the false statement in the tax count, an income tax form, the false statement has to be about something material. And whether the income is taxable or not is material. And so the question of source is directly relevant to that question.
That doesn't mean it can't be subject to a Fifth Amendment privilege.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think that's certainly true, but I think the question is whether for accepting responsibility, the district court or the defendant has admitted the conduct comprising the offense of conviction by disclosing relevant information beyond the mere technical element.
Isn't the touchstone whether the information that the defendant fails to disclose would be something that would put him at greater jeopardy than he already is? Isn't that what the rule is trying to get at?
Well, certainly that's what the Fifth Amendment rule is trying to get at, I think. But I don't think the district court, I think by talking about what the... By focusing on the source, the district court wasn't necessarily focusing on the source, but was looking for a candid and full unraveling of the
circumstances. Why was it necessary to look for the source? I mean, he had already admitted that he lied on the income tax return. Why was it important to determine the source?
I don't think it was. I'm sorry if I've misspoken. I think the district court wasn't probing the source. My initial point is simply that source isn't totally irrelevant. It's not this other separate thing that he's, you know, subject to self-incrimination for. It's this, the source is was very much tied early on to whether the income was taxable. Whether the income was taxable is a question of whether the government could prove the materiality standard of 7206. But what the district court found that the defendant did here was offer instead this narrow plea to the elements in the indictment and didn't cooperate with probation, wouldn't even talk about his financial situation and give, again, a full and candid unraveling.
Yeah, but didn't the probation office recommend that he receive credit for acceptance of responsibility?
The probation office initially did. When the government pointed out, though, in its sentencing memorandum that he'd refused to cooperate with the probation office, the probation's response was, well, we leave that to the discretion of the district court. They acknowledged that he had, in fact...
They didn't change their recommendation.
They didn't change the recommendation, but in the addendum, they did acknowledge that he refused to speak with them and left it to the district court, saying that the district court would be in the best position to determine the sincerity of Mr. Sani's acceptance.
The district court, this is a 261 on the JA, the district court in hearing the defendant's allocution, says, well, they obviously didn't pry everything open, Mr. Sandy, because they don't know still where the money came from. You do, they don't. Now, that's immediately before pronouncing sentence, and it certainly seems to suggest that the sentence was predicated in part on the refusal to reveal the source of the funds, which I think you acknowledged may be subject to a Fifth Amendment privilege.
Well, I think that, with respect, Judge Ginsburg, that comment by the district court takes place in response to Mr. Sani's allocution, where he's saying that they've pried into everything into my life. And the district court simply acknowledges, well, they haven't pried into everything. They don't know where the money came from. And then the district court is very clear to state, look, I'm not asking you a question. I respect your Fifth Amendment rights. But he's simply acknowledging a fact that what Mr. Sani is saying about how the government has pried into everything in his life was not the case.
Well, let's go back to 255. Were you able to find in your research any case in the circuit or any other comparable factually where a government employee opened a myriad of false bank accounts in foreign countries, employees managed all this money, and the myriad of bank accounts that were found, there may be others that haven't been found, that's a separate issue. The ones that were found had millions of dollars from those accounts during a time when he was a full-time employee of the government and couldn't possibly have had any lawful way to be earning that money. Now, it's pretty clear, isn't it, that the district court is saying, I have to infer here that the money had an unlawful source because he won't tell us what it was.
Well, with respect, Judge Ginsburg, we would disagree that that's the import of that comment. That conversation is taking place in the context of with the district court justifying a sentence, and he's talking about deterrence, deterring others. And the district court is simply acknowledging that Sani had millions and millions of dollars in his bank account and that it was still unexplained how it was a lawful source. I think that's different than a finding, which the district court refused to make, that the funds were from an unlawful source, that the government had not proved that by preponderance of the evidence.
And well, I think if it's different, it's a very slight difference. He says he was a full-time employee of the government and couldn't possibly have had any lawful way to be earning that money.
Well,
that's not an inference that it was an unlawful source of the money?
I don't think it necessarily is, Judge Ginsburg, and I appreciate the sort of fine line that one has to slice to understand it that way, unless I think you're looking at the entire context. Again, talking about deterrence of others similarly situated to the defendant, that would be a senior contracting officer in a war zone in charge of moving significant amount of monies and socking away and concealing.
Deterring other people from invoking their Fifth Amendment right, since you leave us with no alternative but to infer an unlawful conduct.
Well, I guess what I was going to finish saying, Judge Ginsburg, is that deterring others in that situation from socking away and concealing millions of dollars for which there appears to be no lawful explanation, but that, again, I think it's perhaps a fine slice, but it's not necessarily finding that the money is, in fact, unlawful.
Suppose there had been a lawful explanation. It still would have been a tax offense. He didn't report it in the income.
That's correct. Right?
And that's what he was convicted of.
That's correct.
So what is why is the inquiry into anything beyond the tax offense an inquiry into anything other than an inquiry into additional violations?
No.
As to which he's invoked his right.
Well, I think, and you've pointed to page 255 in the joint appendix, Judge Ginsburg, it is an inquiry into the circumstances of the offense and what justifies a variance under 3553A. And the two factors that the district court focused on the most were deterrence of others that were similarly situated and the seriousness of the offense. And I think the district court was right to look at all the circumstances surrounding the tax offense. It wasn't just someone falsifying income tax reports for a number of years. It was a senior contracting official who had a position of great sensitivity, a top secret clearance, who was moving significant amounts of money or responsible in some form or another for significant amounts of money.
Under 3553A, as I understand it, you have to be, the district judge has to consider, not just the offense, but the history and characteristics of the defendant. And that would imply considering the person's everything they've done.
I think that's absolutely right, yeah. Judge Kavanaugh. Yeah. And I think that these considerations, the deterrence and the seriousness of the offense, tie directly into Mr. Sani's position and who he was and how he was acting. If I can turn to the disruption of the governmental function, I just like to clarify one point, and that is that the disruption was not simply the investigation of the crime. The Schilling Declaration details the serious impact that Mr. Sani's conduct had on the Army Contracting Command and the Office of the Military Cooperation in Kuwait.
That's really, as Ms. Schertler said, because of the government position, right? Because he was in a government position. And won't that then mean that every government official who engages in tax fraud thereby has significantly disrupted a governmental function, namely the office in which he or she worked?
I don't think, with respect to Judge Kavanaugh, I don't think it's that broad. I think it would be heavily fact-intensive, which is why the district court, I think, should be entitled to its due deference on this
maybe
question.
Maybe heavily fact-intensive, right. But you're going to come to the same conclusion in every case with a government official, I think.
I don't think it would be. I think if you had a government official, again, who was in a similar position of sensitivity where they are in charge of money and awarding contracts and then has, you know, millions of dollars suddenly appear unexplained in their informed bank
accounts. Why would they have to be a government official in charge of contracts? Why wouldn't any government official who mysteriously shows up with a lot of money in their bank account be immediately suspect? Not just contracting officers, but anyone who occupies a position of influence that could be bribed, right?
Judge Griffith, that's certainly true. I don't know that, I mean, I guess the district court would have to make the determination, though, whether that position would lead to or resulted in, whether the investigation of that official then resulted in the requisite disruption.
You say the disruption here was the investigation that was necessary to ferret out suspected wrongdoing?
I was starting to say that it wasn't just the investigation, and that the declaration actually outlines how Sani's removal caused disruptions in the form of redos of, for example, all of the vehicle leasing contracts that Sani.
Were those investigations that would not have taken place but for his removal, or were they investigations that would have been swept up in the larger investigation of corruption in the office?
I think it's safe to assume that those are investigations that would have occurred or would not have occurred but for Sani's conduct of filing false income tax returns. Again, they focus on him, and of all his contracts, there wouldn't be any other reason. It's my understanding that they didn't go through, to the extent they went with Sani, every single contracting officer in Iraq. I would think that would be impossible to do.
Wait a minute. There were a bunch of people in his office who were convicted, right?
There were. There was definitely an investigation.
There was an office-wide investigation that led to the conviction of, I think, three officers, military officers, as well as perhaps some civilians. Pardon me. So it may have been impractical to go through and unnecessary and without reason to go through all the contracts let by all of the offices all over Iraq. They had reason to focus on this office.
Right.
And then something happened that led to focusing on a few individuals.
But I think that what the record shows is that when you focus on the few individuals, and with especially Mr. Sani, that but for his false income tax returns, they would not have they would not have gone to the extent that they did through the all of the contracts that he ever touched, the vehicle leasing contracts and the housing leases. I mean, I think that would be simply common sense in the context of a criminal investigation that's ferreting out bribery. If I could say one.
Think about Operation Greylord for a minute. The FBI is investigating bribery among judges in Cook County, Illinois. I think 13 or 14 ultimately go to jail. But as a sequel to that, let's assume that the state has to reopen and reconsider and look at convictions or acquittals in a number of cases handled by those judges, right, to further determine whether others were involved or whatever it is. That's certainly a disruption, right, an additional undertaking.
That's, I apologize, the second?
The second, yes, the consequential investigation that goes beyond the conviction of the and removal of the judges.
I think it would certainly depend on whether the government.
So in other words, the government proves bribery in three civil cases, right? But there are plenty of other civil cases that were handled by this judge, and the state authorities now have to review lots of them.
I think that could qualify for a upward departure.
Okay, how is that different than what we have here in terms of resulting in a disruption?
Well, I think
the conduct of conviction resulting in a disruption.
Well, it wouldn't be it would depend on whether it was in fact the offense of conviction that actually resulted in, or whether it was some other kind.
It was the fact of conviction, I guess, right, for something. It wasn't a conviction for driving offense. It was for something related to the work of the office.
Then I think the district court could consider giving a upper departure under 5K2.7. If but for the
now, let's
offense of conviction.
Suppose it's not related to the work of the office. Right. So the judge in Illinois or the contracting officer in Iraq is convicted of drunk driving.
Then I don't think that you could make this the same argument.
And
I
so
don't
here he's convicted of filing a false tax return.
Right. But the circumstances surrounding the false tax return, I think, certainly are related to the investigation that follows. That is, it's not drunk driving or drug trafficking. It's hiding and concealing millions of dollars and lying about it on your income tax returns.
But if it's related to the conduct of the work of the office, then the question directed to him about the source is directly about a Fifth Amendment problem, isn't it? Or creates a Fifth Amendment problem.
I'm not sure I'm following the last step.
Well, you're saying
I apologize.
You're saying that it is connected to the work of the office because he's a contract officer handling millions of dollars. But filing a false tax return isn't inherently related to that. It's because there's very large sums of unexplained money, and he handles very large sums of money on behalf of the government, none of which is thought to be missing, but a question is raised. So I don't see how a question pursuing an investigation of him about the source is beyond his assertion of his Fifth Amendment privilege.
That may be the case, Judge Ginsburg. I guess I would simply point out that I don't think the district court ever actually did probe on the source. And I guess we've talked about certain aspects in the record where it looks like he did, and I just don't think the district court did. I'm way over my time, unless the court has any other questions.
Do you have another appointment?
No, I don't, Judge.
I'll keep you from another courtroom if you
do. Not at all.
Okay, thank you.
Your Honors, I wanted to use my minute or less that I have just to address an exchange that occurred where Judge Ginsburg pointed out a finding at 255 of the record by the court, which seems to be an observation, i.e., a finding.
It's a question.
It is a question to counsel.
It's a question about case law. Have you found any case law? I don't see how that's a finding.
Well, it's a rhetorical question because it shows the district court's conclusions about what this case involves. And what the district court says is, did you find a case comparable to this one, where, among other things, he couldn't possibly have had any lawful way to be earning that money? Now, Judge Kavanaugh,
take a hypothetical or even a close, not completely hypothetical question at oral argument and convert that into a finding, that's going to really put district judges on the knife's edge at sentencing when they're trying to explore different legal issues and factual issues. I mean, I think that's really hyper nitpicking to focus on that.
Well, but Judge Kavanaugh, and your follow-up question was to my colleague, well, isn't that a proper thing for the court to consider under 3553, all the things that the defendant might have done? And I wanted to respond to that because 3553 does obviously give the court a great deal of discretion to consider many factors. But there's also an overarching legal principle here that when there are disputed facts, particularly about alleged criminal conduct that is not the offense of conviction, that the district court has obligations to make factual findings. And here, if we are to permit a district court to have to essentially, you disagree with me, I mean, I stand by this record, essentially bury a factual finding in its remarks with counsel and rely on that under 3553, the appellant is deprived of the ability to bring that factual challenge to you, the Court of Appeals, and raise a challenge to it. And that's why this is procedurally an unsound way to proceed. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Your Honor. If there are
I have one other question, which is you request that the case be assigned to a new judge on remand. And I also thought that was a fairly extraordinary request, given that it's based apparently on the fact that the district judge here was not a fan of the guideline calculation in this case, or maybe of the guidelines generally. And that is a widely shared phenomenon among district judges, as you're aware. To reassign cases just because they're articulating concerns about some of the difficulties of the post-Booker jurisprudence would seem very extraordinary.
And that would be extraordinary, and that is not the reason that we are requesting reassignment. And we acknowledge that it is an unusual request to make. What I would direct the court to as the basis for our request is this district court's pledge to this court, let there be no doubt in the mind of the Court of Appeals that regardless of the number of errors that this court finds with that court's guidelines rulings, nothing would matter. And, Your Honors, we would submit that that is one of those extraordinary situations where the appearance of fairness.
Don't you think that's what's going on a lot of times now in district court sentencing, which is, okay, I'm going to go through all the hoops that are necessary to get the correct guidelines calculation. But under Booker, I'm then going to base the sentence on all the facts and circumstances, and I know where I'm going to end up. I'm going to end up at 8 years, say, hypothetically. And I realize procedurally I need to go through these hoops, but I'm going to end up at 8 years, and just that's where I'm going to end up because I've analyzed everything. Isn't that happening
either
implicitly or explicitly in a lot of district court courtrooms today?
Respectfully, Your Honor, we would suggest that those hoops that the district court is required to go through have substance to them, and one of the substances that Gall specifically points out is you need to know a correct guideline range and consider it. And when this district court tells
But you're also allowed to be hostile to it and disregard it and disagree with it and ignore it then. Not ignore it. You have to consider it and
You have to consider it.
And then vary from it significantly.
But you also need to consider the extent of your variance and justify it.
This was a minor variance.
It was. Based on what we consider to be an inflated guidelines level. Now, and what this district court was saying, that even if this guidelines level gets pared back because I've committed errors, it doesn't matter. I would vary more. And, Your Honor, a procedure can be followed where that can be done in a way that is does not offend the appearance of fairness. But when the district court declares that to this court before it ever knows the extent of the errors that it might have occurred and what instructions this court may give it, our submission is that then really that a remand is just, you know, an exercise in formality. And that deprives Mr. Sani of the appearance of a fair sentencing, and it puts And it's very damaging to the public reputation of sentencing proceedings.
No, I think it's damaging to the public reputation of the guidelines, but not to sentencing proceedings generally. District judges have been very open and outspoken about that, and I don't see what the problem is with this. I understand your arguments about the district court may have made errors in the calculations. I'm considering those. But in terms of the reassignment request, the idea that the district judge simply says, this is where I'm going to come out. That seems to be what Booker wants.
Well, Your Honor, we would cite the Second Circuit, whose standard we are reciting and whose standard this court has approved in Gaviria, did reassign a judge based on comments that were not too different from this, based on its finding that you should not remand to a judge who has expressed an opinion that makes it clear remand is an empty gesture. And we believe that that is exactly what one has here. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shirley. Mr. Gingras, thank you. Case is submitted.